koniec myszki.
Mishki here with you. Been looking forward to this interview for a while. Philip Zimbardo is with me, author of The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Prior to reading this book, I suppose I would have been with the vast majority of Americans who, when they stumble upon a situation like what happened at Abu Ghraib prison, or any situation where people you expect to behave one way behave a different way in a way that's rather shocking to you, I was left without answers and with a sense of dismay at what people are capable of. A lot of people had this sort of thing start after World War II, when there was all sorts of questions being asked about how enlightened society like Germany could have had so many supposedly decent, well-adjusted human beings going along with the monster machine that was Nazism. And you can even see yourself asking the questions in small cases, isolated cases. A month ago, I pulled a story from a school in the United States where they decided to help young school kids understand what happened in Germany by having a certain number of kids play the Jews and a certain number of kids play the Nazis. And they had to stop the experiment because it got a little out of hand. The people playing the Nazis, the little kids playing the Nazis, became too abusive to the Jewish kids. Now, these kids weren't actually Jewish, and obviously these Nazis weren't actually Nazis, but in the roles, the cruelty that came out was a bit dismaying to the teachers. And obviously all of us as human beings are constantly looking at why people behave the way they do, and whether there is something called evil and whether it gets inside people and whether the evil are really different from the rest of us. So many of these questions were answered for me in The Lucifer Effect, and that's why I wanted to have Philip Zimbardo on. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, welcome. Delighted to be here and really interested in the study you just talked about. We're having kids role play or simulate the Nazi experience.
Yeah, it was a story that came up in the news just about a week after I finished your book. And as I read the story, I said, boy, I now understand this the way I never would have before. It's fresh in the news, so I'm sure I could find it, but it was a school where annually they, as a way of educating, I think, kids as young as 9, 10, and 11 years of age, they have this role-playing, and I've heard it done at other schools who want to understand apartheid, where they label this kid, the Jews, and these kids over here are the Nazis, and now here's how we'll play it out. Here's how the lunchroom will work, and here's how the school day will go, and you'll have these rights taken from you, and you'll have these powers granted to you. And then the abuse came. The kids were never instructed to hit the kids who were Jewish or to spit on them, and that began to occur. Teachers were appalled, and they stopped it. And having read The Lucifer Effect, it all made sense to me. And I have said on the air since reading your book that I now feel fairly comfortable saying that there's no reason for me to believe, put in the same situation in Abu Ghraib, that I would behave differently. There's no reason for me to believe that when I look at those pictures from those torture scenes at Abu Ghraib that I would have been the one to not participate. I might have been the one to not participate, but odds are against that.
Right.
And so I don't get to say that. I'd come off sounding arrogant and cocky, and there's no evidence to indicate that I would behave any differently. Now, in saying that, it's both satisfying and terrifying.
Right.
Satisfying.
Absolutely.
In that these people weren't monsters. They're human beings, and terrifying in that they were human beings, and we're all capable of that. And your book starts out describing a 71 Stanford University experiment that you became rather famous for, but because it was so long ago, I just wonder how many people in America, percentage-wise, have any idea that this experiment ever occurred. I sometimes worry that knowledge of these things is in such small, isolated circles in this country that the average person just has no idea what's being learned out there.
Oh, I'm so excited to be on your program. First of all, very few people, I've done tons of interviews. Almost no interview has ever read the book. But, you know, that they read the opening chapter, and then they focus on really boring questions. I mean, you raise the fundamental questions that I've been dealing with, not only in the book, but for most of my life, is how do we understand how ordinary people first begin to do bad things, and that over time, evil is a slippery slope. It always starts with a small step, hardly noticeable. And then once you take that step, a little bit illegal, a little greedy, you know, a little immoral, then the next step is easier and easier. And what it's hard for us to realize is how that path is paved with lots of people around us who think of themselves as good people, who are encouraging them. Some encourage by looking the other way. They smile and look the other way and allow it to go on. Others, you know, use euphemisms like be a team player, get with the program. You know, don't be so uptight. Don't be so rigid. You know, loosen up a little bit, meaning loosen up your morality a little bit. You use the word terrifying, and the reason I smile when you did, because in the famous trial of Adolf Eichmann, this is the Nazi monster who orchestrated the deaths of, I don't know, how many millions of Jews in Auschwitz concentration camp. And he was in charge of arranging all the logistics. And, for, you know, it's a hard job for 2 million people to be killed in 3 or 4 months. Well, at his trial, this philosopher, Hannah Arendt, was there and wrote this book called The Banality of Evil, Eichmann on Trial in Jerusalem. And what she said was the horrible thing that she saw and that everybody else saw was that Eichmann was terrifyingly normal, just the word you use, that before he went to Auschwitz, normal. After Auschwitz, normal. But you put him in that situation, give him a role to play, give him an ideology to support, give him all these resources, a title on the door, and suddenly he's doing stuff which is, you know, the ultimate in evil. And so what I try to do in the book is say, you know, the human mind has this infinite capacity to be kind or cruel, caring or selfish, creative or destructive, and it pushes some of us at some times to be villains, other times to be heroes. That's the good message of my book.
Right.
And what we fail to appreciate is how little things in the situation or the behavioral context that we're acting out in can move us in these bad directions. It's not evil writ big. It's really evil writ small that is a danger.
Different people who have reviewed your book have used the image of not thinking of bad apples but bad barrels.
Right.
And as I look at different situations, I realize that there aren't enough people trying to remove systems or situations. People are focusing on, and you can go through the list of the terms they use, thugs, creeps, sickos, right, deviants. But no, few are looking at the system. And in fact, in political circles, when you begin to look at systems, in this country, I know you're often ridiculed,
right,
for failing to hold people accountable individually. That each of us has a choice in every situation, and we can either go bad or go good, and the system itself is irrelevant.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, you're hitting right on the core of everything. And for me, that's important in the book, is that individuals are, of course, always personally accountable. You can't say they made me do it, I was following orders. So you are accountable, and therefore you can't diffuse responsibility knowing that. But all of our systems, our institutions, focus exclusively on the individual. Law, medicine, psychiatry, religion. And they don't give a place for situations that can corrupt good people. And they don't even work into the analysis, the system that creates the situation. So when I look at Abu Ghraib, you know, I'm horrified. In fact, I think tomorrow is the April 28, 2004 is when we saw those horrible pictures. So it's the anniversary. But I was shocked, but I was surprised because, as you said earlier, I saw those same things happening in my simulation, my little experiment 35 years ago, guards stripping prisoners naked, putting bags over their heads, and ending up having them do sexually degrading activities. That's when we blew the whistle, ended the study. The study was supposed to go for 14 days. I had to end it in 6 days because the guards took the power in the role of guard and used it to abuse the prisoners psychologically. I didn't allow them to do physical punishment, but it didn't matter. They broke them. They broke their will in creatively evil ways. And we saw the same thing in Abu Ghraib. And, of course, the military and the Bush administration blamed the few bad apples, the few rogue soldiers. It's the same when you have a scandal in any police department. It's always, don't blame the system. Don't blame us. It's these few bad guys. And then we punish them. So I defended one of these young men, one of these good soldiers, put in that really bad barrel, and he got 8 years, dishonorably discharged. They took away 22 years of his back pay. He is a super patriot. He had 9 medals and awards, and they stripped that publicly. Well, no senior officer has been tried for creating that horrible situation that they put him and these other Army reservists in. And again, these were Army reservists, meaning they were weekend soldiers who had no training to be in a prison in a combat zone. And yet they just dumped them there and gave them permission to soften up the prisoners. Because why did the abuses happen there? Well, that was the interrogation soft torture center. This is where they had 1,000 detainees, usually whole men and boys, the whole families they picked up. They were trying to find that information about the insurgency. Most of these people had no information to give. And so they were the CIA was there, the military intelligence. They're really frustrated. And they turn to these military policemen and say, your job is to help us soften these guys up. And so they start softening them up. And then over time, it escalates or de-escalates into this horrible sexual pictures that we've seen.
You must have been, back in 1971, you must have been about as shocked as a researcher can be. I'm trying to think of anybody getting results that would be more disturbing that quickly. For those who just want me to flesh this out a little bit more, it was 71. Researchers at Stanford created a simulated prison in the basement of the campus, a psychology building. They randomly assigned 24 students to be the prison guards or prisoners for 2 weeks. And yet, within days, the guards become these sort of swaggering, sadistic individuals to the point where they're placing bags over the prisoners' heads, forcing them to strip, and encouraging them to perform sex acts. And it's so disturbing for you. And these are people who are screened ahead of time and are just healthy, average, normal American young adults. And all of a sudden, these terrible things are happening, and really, hours have gone by, a few days. It hasn't even been enough time to expect anything like this. And this landmark experiment sort of shocked the psychology community. And I know it isn't the only time an experiment like this has shocked me. I remember being in college and in my first psychology 101 class being shown that film footage of something that relates but is somewhat different, and that's the study where the students were, you can help me with this, where they were electrocuting or thinking they were electrocuting others for giving wrong answers, and it was an authority who was encouraging them?
Yeah, it's a famous study by a psychologist named Stanley Milgram. It preceded my study.
Oh, it did, okay.
Yeah, and it was done at Yale, but it wasn't with students. This was... What he did is he moved it to the next level. He said, I want ordinary townspeople. So he tested 500 people in New Haven, Connecticut, and 500 more in Bridgeport. And essentially it was an experiment in the lab coat said, we want to help people improve their memory by punishing errors. Your job as a teacher is to punish errors of this nice guy when he makes an error. And he's in another room. And you start shocking him. and you start at you start at 15 volts and you increase it by 30 each time, and the guy is not even responding. So the key is that the first step on the path to evil are very small, but the guy is making errors, and now you're getting up to 200, 300 volts. The guy's screaming his brains out, and then the question is, will you go all the way to 450 volts? And, you know, who would do that? That sounds crazy. In fact, the majority, two-thirds, went all the way, starting it with 15 volts to 450. And when you get up to 375, the guy screams and it's silent. So he could be unconscious. He could be dead. So, in fact, and you keep going. So what the Milgram study showed was the power of the situation in a, where there's one-on-one. We have a powerful authority and an individual. The Stanford Prison Study is really about institutional power. Because I realize that it's rare that somebody says, do these bad things. It's more often you're in a classroom, you're in a family, you're in a hospital, you're in a prison. We live our lives in institutions where nobody exactly tells you to do bad things. They just create an environment where bullying is allowed or teasing is allowed or racist, sexist jokes are allowed. And once they're allowed, then you know it can only get worse and worse.
Why do each of us want to hurt others? Why is it a fact that each one of us has a part of us that enjoys hurting another person?
You know, that's really a tough question. And the way I've tried to figure it out, and in the process of writing this book, which I spent about 2.5 years doing, it forced me to face a lot of these ugly things. And I have to say that in the Stanford Prison Study, it was not only the kids that got caught up in it. I got caught up in it. I put myself in the role of prison superintendent, and I did terrible things in that role. That is, I watched kids have emotional breakdowns and said, too bad, let's move on, let's get a replacement. When in my normal state as a lovable, caring teacher, father, husband, I would have said, stop the study the first time the first kid broke down. But because I'm playing that role, and that ties back to the thing you opened the program with, of these kids playing the role of Nazis or Jews, roles can take over on us. We become the boss. We become the foreman. We become the prison guard. I don't think that we want to hurt people. I think evil is about the exercise of power. And I think that's what it is that when we see evil, when we see people doing evil or hear about it, it's really we're fascinated with the fact that anybody has the power, the will to do this kind of thing that you couldn't imagine doing. But once anybody does it, then what? It becomes imaginable. And so I think evil is really all about power and control and domination. And so we see it at one level. We say, oh, isn't that terrible? But then why do we want to keep watching the replay over and over again, you know, of,
right.
of the massacre, I mean, the massacres or Virginia Tech or the 9/11 even. And I think it's not that we want to hurt people or we like to see people hurt. That's the byproduct. The important thing is that anybody could do that.
Right. That makes a lot of sense to me, the idea of it wanting to experience that power and the attraction of that is attractive to each of us. And perhaps we all find it in different ways, and some ways are acceptable.
Yeah, well, you remember Henry Kissinger, who, you know, may be a good man in some ways, but I never thought of him as very attractive. And when he was powerful in Washington, he had all these attractive women around. And when somebody asked him about it, he said, it's called the aphrodisiac of power.
Yeah.
That it's power. Power is arousing. And that's why, you know, even people like Donald Trump, I mean, you know, I find him an obnoxious person, but he has so much power that people are attracted, even to people who are abusive, obnoxious in various ways, or the guy on Idol, the British guy,
yeah.
you know, he's horrible, you know, with the kinds of things he says to demean contestants, and he gets a huge salary. He probably gets a bonus the more horrendous he is, and it's only because he has the power to humiliate people. Well, you know, if you're the person being humiliated, that's evil.
Right, right. You're listening to Philip Zimbardo, author of the book The Lucifer Effect, which talks about, or in there you'll find written exactly what we're talking about and a lot more. It's an extraordinary way to help all of us understand a little bit more what we see going on locally, nationally, in the world, and causes you to do a lot of thinking long after you close the cover. We'll be back to finish up with Philip after this. Stick around. Welcome back to the broadcast. We're discussing the book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, by Philip Zimbardo. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and has taught at Yale and New York University and Columbia. And he's been at this for decades. One of the reasons we have to go back to 1971 to talk about this Stanford study, where they simulated a prison situation in the basement of the psychology building, randomly assigned these students to be the prison guards or prisoners, and then had to kill the experiment within days because of the abuse that was going on. One of the reasons we have to go back that far to that study, or to the Milgram study, which we talked about in the first segment, is because we can't do these experiments anymore. They've been... the idea is that too much damage is done to human beings. In the case of the Stanford study, we had psychological or emotional breakdowns that took some time to heal. And I guess the thinking is, Philip, that we can experiment on mice, but we got to quit doing it on each other.
Yeah, it's really a major problem that the Milgram experiment, which you described earlier, and the Stanford Prison Study, and anything like it, obviously now is forbidden. That is, in one way, it's good that there's a new consciousness that says, you know, people in experiments, whether students or ordinary citizens, you know, have to be protected from, you know, excessive abuse. That researchers can go over the top in wanting to prove a point. On the other hand, the pendulum has swung so far the other way that not only can't you do these kinds of studies. In some cases, you can't even ask people questions that might be distressing to them. In which case, then, you know, how can you ever begin to understand, you know, these basic issues about human nature, especially human nature going wrong? Because the goal of the research is not simply to demonstrate, look what bad people, what good people can do. The goal is, how do we begin to develop a kind of public health model which says, once we understand the causes of evil, then we go beyond just focusing on treating the individuals. We do what we do in public health when there's an epidemic. We say, how do we begin to inoculate people against evil? Think of evil like it was a disease, and there's a flu out there. It's not enough to treat each person who comes to the doctor's office. You say, wait a minute, there is a virus out there that we have to stop it where it begins. And so this is the point you made earlier, is that once we understand how situations can corrupt good people, and that what is the system, whether it's a cultural, political, economic, historical context, you know, that creates those situations, that legalizes them, keeps them going, then we as citizens are in a position to say, we oppose that, and we want to change it. You know, when you talk about the Nazi, you know, the terrible things that happened in Nazi Germany, that didn't happen overnight. That took years to set up. That, you know, Hitler's system first perverted education, had kids forced to read comic books in which Jews were portrayed as vermin, as horrendous. And then at the end of the comic book, it shows pictures kicking Jews out of school, kicking them out of your country. And then the last step is the final solution. So if you pervert the educational system, you begin to have laws that first start little, you know, Jews can't do this, Jews can't do that. And once people get used to those limits on their freedom, then you make them more and more extreme. And then finally, people don't realize that, you know, they are part of an evil system.
Isn't it amazing, though, that while that occurred over a long period of time, when you look at how swiftly the genocide occurred in Rwanda, you had situations where up until the massacre is called for, you have neighbor enjoying the company of neighbor, going across the street, sharing meals, loaning certain ingredients for food, helping out with the laundry, nice people across the street. It's just that on one side it's Tutsis, on the other side it's Hutus. And immediately following the massacre, these people go right back again to this sort of well-adjusted person who's ready to get along with everybody. But there was this period of insanity. And, right. And of course, the problem is it's not insanity. And that's, I think, what your book, that's how your book can scare somebody, because you realize there was nothing weird or odd about the Hutus. There was nothing different right. about them. We all could have done that. Each of us could have taken a machete and gone to town on somebody and killed them. And we don't believe we could have, but your book shows we could have.
Yeah, it's you know, we're afraid of weapons of mass destruction. The reason we went to war in Iraq. In Rwanda, in 3 months, 800,000 people were killed. And the weapon of mass destruction was the military gave machetes to the men and just clubs, bats to the women. But what the key was, they said, the Tutsis are your enemy. They are an enemy of the state. Their existence undercuts everything that's good about the Tutsi nation, and gave them permission to kill their neighbors. And women, not only men, the men not only killed, they raped. The women also killed, most of the women killed the children, beating them to death. And how could that be? I'm saying in 3 months, it was this mass slaughter. Well, one of the keys is always an ideology. So somebody in power says, you know, this is good or that's bad. And then gives you reasons why, gives you the means to you know, satisfy that end, gives you a role to play. You are warriors against, you know, evil and so forth. And then gives you permission to do things which normally are immoral, evil, illegal. And it clearly could happen again.
It's strange to walk out your front door, see your neighbor across the street grabbing his newspaper, and say to yourself, that scene could happen right here, given certain circumstances. Not given a radical change in how that person was raised by his mother. Given a change in circumstances.
Well, I mean, again, we had it in America in the 50s with Joe McCarthy, simply labeling somebody as a communist, as a commie, as a pinko. You know, nobody beat them up, but people lost their jobs. They were discriminated against. It was horrendous. And why was that? Because communism was the enemy. Well, you know, a little earlier, fascism was the enemy with Hitler and Mussolini and Tocho in Japan. So it's very easy for a nation to get caught up, the individual nation to get caught up in this ideology where somebody at the top says communism is good or communism is bad, fascism is good, fascism is bad. You know, there were torture centers throughout South America and Greece. Where the enemy of the people was socialists and communists. A lot of them, college professors and students who were tortured, who were killed, you know, in Argentina and Chile and Brazil. In my book, I talk about, I actually went to Brazil and interviewed some of these guys who were tortured, death squad executioners. Again, totally normal now, but for 5 years, what they did was the state said, that's your enemy. Get the information, which is going to help our nation survive, and then kill them. And these guys did. Week in, week out, it was their job.
Now, we should point out that in every one of these situations, there are always going to be exceptions. There are strong people, people who have it within themselves to resist. We obviously saw it in Nazi Germany, and we certainly saw it with the whistleblower in Abu Ghraib.
Absolutely.
There are always going to be people who don't go along, but what the Lucifer effect argues is that that's going to always be a small minority. The vast majority will invariably, if the system fits this certain criteria, will go along because that's how we're made. I have this one story. I found it in case you ever want to look it up. It's from April 11th. I'll just give you it real quick. A school role-playing exercise on the Holocaust went horribly wrong when some students took the lessons too far and the quote-unquote Germans spat on and punched the quote-unquote Jews. Obviously, these were just people playing roles. The Academy School in Waxahachie, which is 50 miles south of Dallas, runs the role-play every year to teach students about intolerance and discrimination.
Well.
Okay, they're not as young as I thought. They're freshmen in high school. During the role play, students tagged as Jews were forced to stand against the wall as the Germans passed by the hallway. The Jewish students had to pick up everyone's garbage at lunchtime and were the last to eat. But teachers found that the exercise got out of hand when the German students began to spit on and punch the Jewish students, something they were not told to do.
Right.
They would push them down the stairs. They would be more rude to them than it was suggested they be. It got over the edge. They had to stop it, and they don't know if they're going to have it again next year. Now, again, after reading your book, you come across something like this, and you say, well, of course.
Yes. Well, see, again, it's two things I want to respond to. First this, and then the point you mentioned earlier about heroes. An even more dramatic study was done with fourth-grade school children in Riceville, Iowa, by a wonderful teacher named Miss Jane Elliott. And what she did is even simplify it. She came in the classroom one day and said, you know what? I just discovered that brown-eyed children are inferior and blue-eyed children are superior, and then told them all the bad things about people who have brown eyes. And she said, and therefore, brown-eyed kids have to wear a brown collar so everybody will identify them. And within minutes, this is in a small town where these kids live side by side. Mostly white kids in a farming community. The blue-eyed kids started discriminating against them. They started beating them up. They started saying, we got to tell the cafeteria people that brown eyes are coming because they're likely to cheat. And then the next day she comes in and says, I made a mistake. It's the other way around. I'm really sorry. And what happens? They didn't learn compassion. You put the brown eyes in position of power and they do the same thing. They dominate the blue eyes. And Mrs. Elliott has now been doing that study not just with little kids, and she's just an elementary teacher, not a psychologist, although it's a brilliant psychology. She's been doing this with adults in businesses. She does the same thing. And what she says is you pick any characteristic. I mean, people have a big nose versus small nose, big lips versus small lips, and somebody in authority says that is bad or that is good, and you give people, see, the key is you give people permission.
Right.
Then in that particular setting, that's why the Lucifer effect says we got to understand the situations in which we're asked to behave, and behavior goes awry, it goes over the top.
Disturbing lessons and important lessons to learn, and that's why I encourage people to get a hold of this book, The Lucifer Effect, Philip Zimbardo, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. It will change the way you look at the world, the way you read the news every day in the paper, and the way you look at yourself as well. Thank you so much for your good work on this and your time today.
Oh, thank you. I love being on your program, and, you know, let's do it another time.
All right. Thanks again. Have a good day.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, back to Mishki on AM 1500 KSTP.
Every day at 12:46, we go to the news with Johnny.
I think it's usually about 12:30, Tommy.
12:30, 12:46.
Give or take. Partly sunny.
You know, yeah. I don't know if you're aware, but when there are prophecies and that sort of thing, and they say something's going to happen, they don't nail it down to the minute.
Oh, okay. I understand.
And if that's the way it operates in the spiritual world, who the hell are you to think it should be different for a little human being, in essence an ant, moving about the universe?
I didn't mean for you to take it so personally, Tommy.
12:46.
Okay, thank you, Tommy. Partly sunny at 67 degrees. We now have two versions of a statewide smoking ban. The House passed one yesterday that allows ventilated smoking rooms and bars, rooms where employees would not be allowed to work. Senate version allows smoking on outdoor patios, also a place where employees would not be allowed to work. Representative Dan Severson of Sauk Rapids says it still allows smokers some freedom, though.
We're not telling smokers they can't smoke. We're telling smokers...
I think if we vilify
that
smokers...
That they can't give their secondhand smoke to other people in public places.
And if authority figures give people permission, we could have a sort of a genocide where we just eradicate the smokers.
All the smokers, yeah.
And it's hard to believe that you, Johnny, could one day chop my arms off with a machete. But you could. I look at you now. Yes, you could. You don't think you could, but you got it in you.
Okay.
And that's, remember the first time you pulled the legs off a daddy long leg when you were a little kid? That was the beginning. And I hope
I
it doesn't end.
That.
John.
I never did.
What cruel things did you do?
I didn't like killing bugs, even. I didn't even like killing box elder bugs when I was a child, which my mother thought was very odd.
How do you get that feeling of power that you need as a human being? Where do you get that? Where did you get that as a kid?
I don't know.
Beat up anybody? Were you ever bully anybody?
No, I've never actually even been in a fight.
I worry when someone has not had any time at all on the dark side that just one day they're going to snap. When we deny it for decades, one day it just pow. One day you're going to be here, pleasant little Johnny Hyatt reading the news, and you're going to, and Speed, you're going to get your little head snapped off in there. And I'm going to say, I get it. Is everybody else going, how could he? How could I? I get it. I don't like it. I get it.
So you won't be the one saying I was a loner and didn't have any friends, huh? You won't be that guy?
What I'll say is, John spent his whole life denying his own shadow side.
Okay.
Until it came and said, we will not be given short shrift anymore. And boom. That's how it works, Johnny.
Okay.
You better start experimenting with a little more assertiveness and get angry with me occasionally. Get mad at me for the abuse that I send your way. Sometimes don't laugh and say, that was uncalled for, Tommy, and I don't like it. It hurts.
Okay.
Okay,
but
John.
It doesn't really hurt, Tommy. Backers of a retractable roof stadium for the Vikings showed off full-color drawings of their dream to the Senate Taxes Committee this morning. But stadium supporters aren't saying how much state money they want. The team has sought state help.
I put a frog in a bucket with a snake and just to watch what the snake would do. That frog was terrified, absolutely terrified. And I enjoyed watching it when I was a young boy.
Well, that would be interesting, actually, a sort of science experiment. I could see that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if someone hadn't stopped me, one day down the line, I would have been putting a four-year-old in a cage with something.
So you got yelled at for that one then, did you?
I should not have been allowed to parent without some of that being looked at by a therapist.
President Bush is warning Congress he'll keep vetoing war spending bills as long as they contain a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq. He spoke at Camp David the day after the Senate approved legislation calling for a pullout to begin by October. Two St. Paul brothers debut a movie of theirs tonight at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City. Drew and John Dowdle, who grew up in Highland Park, won't say much about their film, The Poughkeepsie Tapes, other than it's just about a serial killer and it's scary.
It's a docu-horror, is what we're calling it. It's kind of a blended documentary
exploring
horror
that
concept,
side
which
and
I don't really believe has been done before.
Getting it out of their system on film, nobody has to be hurt, people are well paid, everybody goes home, and yet they got to dance with the devil a little bit. Know what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Maybe tonight when you go home, you and your wife could role play.
Okay.
Now, this is none of my business, but if it comes to pass, maybe Monday you can tell me a little something about it.
Okay. Four members of the Five Eyewitness News team appear in the movie, Brad Satin and Jennifer Griswold as reporters.
I like Escape Convict and the Warden's Wife.
Do you?
You like that game? Escape Convict and the Warden's Wife.
Maybe.
All right. You would have said no.
Okay. Oh,
I'm moving, stepping out.
I see.
Just a little bit of pressure, and already you're going dark.
My Eyewitness News weather forecast. 72 today, a few clouds, 48 overnight, mostly sunny and 76 right now. A few clouds, 67 degrees at AM 1500.
Who took my birds without permission? People keep going into my sound effects library and taking my stuff. That's not just some bird sound from the library here. Most of my stuff is from outside KSTP. Those birds came from Cornell. You go get your own birds from Cornell. Those are my Cornell University birds. Someone's going in, and Brad's doing that, isn't he? He's taking my birds. A lot of this stuff is my own stuff here. Where are my birds? There are my birds. See, that's what it was. As soon as I heard that right there, that sound, I knew it was mine. Mishke here for Homestead Mortgage. You ever want to pull the legs off a loan officer? They have one loan officer at Homestead with prosthetics. You can do it. You get the same feeling that people who pull legs off in other countries have, but you're just taking prosthetics and everybody laughs. You will not hear another mortgage ad start this way in the United States in 2007. And really, that's all I'm going for on this show. I'm just trying to periodically do something I know won't be done again and hasn't been done up till now. On my deathbed, I will peacefully slip away knowing that. There is another way to do a mortgage ad. You start talking about, no closing costs. But see, that's a con. When you hear that you are being conned, I will not con you. Because when you hear no closing costs, what you think is, oh, that'll save me money. No. No. No, they get their money. Look at the interest rate when you see no closing cost. It's going to be higher. They get their money. I don't like lying to you people. I take that back. I like lying to you people, but I'm not right now. Not with this ad, because it would affect the credibility I have with my other accounts. It could cost me this account, could take food off my family's table, and I won't have that unless ordered to by an authority figure. At which point, only Lutherans will be banned from using Homestead Mortgage. What is happening to me, Speed? This is supposed to be a ad that helps people call up a mortgage company and get a home loan, a refinancing package, or a consolidation loan. And right now, I've already told Lutherans they can't call. Or did I say that? I don't know what I said. Maybe it was just the brown-eyed people. By the way, someone just tuning in right now is very lost, and I'm sorry about that. If you can't listen to the whole show, bye-bye. Sorry you even like talk radio, freaks. Homestead Mortgage, 651-490-5555.
Mishki, AM 1500, KSTP.
I play this in a coffee shop the other day. You don't generally think of Led Zeppelin songs being played in coffee shops. Got a little weird at the end, but in the beginning it seemed to fit. Everyone was enjoying their lattes and saying, a nice tune. What's this one, Benny?
You got the look I need.
Nice music. Now, where'd you find this guy?
Maybe more than enough.
Yes, put a dollar in a tip jar.
Oh, darling, darling, darling. Oh,
glad you're not getting
me
that real loud, crazy rock and roll stuff.
Oh,
I don't care for that at all.
So much.
That's why I go to coffee shops.
So much.
This is lovely. I'm going to bring my wife
so
in.
Much.
She thought you were doing a rock and roll thing. She wanted to stay in the car. I just go up and put this down. Yeah, then it got a little weird. It's unfortunate. Place has good coffee, too. Well, what happens in the next hour? The next hour brings an interview with Lucifer himself, providing a rebuttal to Philip Zimbardo. Along with Lucifer will be one of his hellhounds. What's Jimmy's last name? Charlie escapes me. Suhan. Always disturbing. Well, it used to be disturbing when that stuff happened, but I've accepted it now. Little blips, little things that happen in the brain. Who knows why they're there? Suhan. KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. Back after the news. Stick around.
It's partly sunny and 68 degrees in Minneapolis.
Hey, Johnny.
Paul. Yes.
Angie's handing out a little Mary Jane in the other room if you're interested.
She is. That Angie, I tell you.
Would you like some?
No, thank you, Tommy.
Yeah, let me bring some in. You want some, Speed?
Sure.
Coming in.
Those two women who got into a fistfight in the middle of Interstate 694 during Wednesday's afternoon rush hour have both been charged now with disorderly conduct. 21-year-old Zion Johnson and 34-year-old Jerusha Munger, both from Sag Harbor, New Jersey, and in the same car, each posted $300 bond. They'll appear in court next month. It's still unclear what led to the fight, which tied up traffic for about 20 minutes. The women apparently argued about something, decided to just stop and duke it out on the freeway, providing some entertainment for police and commuters alike, unfortunately caused about a 30-minute delay during rush hour. Get that door for me, Tommy. Thanks. Forbes magazine has named Minneapolis the fifth cleanest city in the world. Only Calgary, Honolulu, Helsinki, and Ottawa are cleaner by their survey. It's based on things like air and water quality, waste removal, and recycling. A man wounded in the Iraq War is now charged with bringing two pipe bombs to a New Ulm College campus last week. 23-year-old Benjamin Ring reportedly takes powerful pain medication for a shoulder injury, including one that makes him hallucinate. His roommate says Ring had been acting strangely that day. Ted Olson, president of Martin Luther College, says he hopes Ring gets the help he needs.
He's a good young man, and our prayers go out for him, and we certainly hope that he will have some sort of recovery and relief from his pain.
At last check, Ring was still being treated in the psychiatric ward of a hospital. He's facing one count of unlawful possession of an explosive. One bomb was detonated by bomb squad. The other was deactivated.
Show Johnny what I gave you there, Speedy. Have you ever seen that?
No, I have not. Is that some sort of candy?
I don't know.
Did you try it?
No, I wanted you guys to try it.
It is candy. I've had it before.
Mary Jane is candy?
Well, this kind of Mary Jane is.
What do you do? Where's the name come from? Is it similar to Baby Ruth, where you can track it back to the original whoever?
I don't know. Should I type it into a search engine?
Would you mind?
Would you mind? Five Eyewitness News weather forecast. Partly cloudy, 48 overnight tonight. Sunny, 76 tomorrow, and sunny and 82 for
when I was a kid,
Sunday.
We called a pot good and plenty. Good and plenty.
Right now, partly sunny, 68 degrees at AM 1500 KSTP.
Can you still get good and plenties? Put that in a search engine.
Now, broadcasting from the border country of Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's Mishki.
Go ahead, Speak. Tell us.
Well, in 1914, Charles N. Miller named this bite-sized peanut butter and molasses candy for his favorite aunt, Mary Jane.
Great. That's great. And how about Good and Plenty's? How come you can't find them around anymore? See what's going on there. Good and Plenty. Uh-oh. What is this here? Oh, boy. Bush is in trouble. The Bushman. I hate to see this. Is this accurate? Bush's approval rating has sunk to 28%, an all-time low for his presidency. I did not expect it to go this low. Bush looking at now only a 28% approval rating. I didn't... What's going on? Hello? Hello? 28%. 28%. Approval rating dipping. 28%. Is that what this is supposed to be? Do I sing to it, or what do I do here? Fine! Celebrating Bush's approval rating. All right, everybody, let's dance. Come on!
Can you go? How low can you go? How low can you go?
Mr. President.
How low can you go?
We're asking. You want to know? What's the record? President Bush's approval rating slipped to new lows in the most recent Harris poll. The first time since these polls have been taking, all political figures and institutions included in the survey have negative performance ratings. Bush hit a high in the aftermath of the terror attacks. 88% approval rating, down to 28% now. Weakest showing since his inauguration. That's the bad news. The good news is he feels good about himself. He likes himself. He gets up in the morning, looks in the mirror, he says, I'm okay. I'm okay. And that's, in the end, what we all got to be able to say when we look in the mirror. You just got to be able to say, I'm okay. I'm a good man. I may not be the best president. This might not have been the best job for me, but I'm a good man. Oil prices hover near $65 a barrel. You know what I did today? I bought a barrel of oil. First time. Just to see if I could. Sure enough, it ran about $65. I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. But I got a barrel of oil. Right now I'm just using it to hold up a picket fence that's fallen over in the far end of the backyard. Thought of giving it as a gift to someone. I don't know what kind of person you would give a barrel of oil to, someone who collects that sort of thing. I know I was one time given 25 head of cattle and had no idea what to do with that. I live in the city. Told the fella I'd hang on to him for the weekend, but come Monday, I'd like him picked up. I had no use for him. That was one long weekend. That was one long weekend. By Monday, I might have had 3 or 4 head of cattle. It was an ugly, messy, brutal weekend. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Misty.
How are you?
Okay, I got some happy news.
Let's see. Let me get the sounder for that. We generally don't go to happy news without the happy news sounder. No, I'll get it. It's my song.
It's time for happy news. It's time for happy news. Everyone needs good news every once in a while. It's time for happy news. It's time for happy news on the Misty Broadcast.
That's Michael Lunan and the Loony Bin Band. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Go ahead with your good news.
Well, there's a Royal Model typewriter in front of me. It seems like such an early model, it doesn't have a model number. Someone threw it out. They had a nail stuck in the keys, and it was all gunked up. I cleaned it, and well, it's fine.
It's an old Royal, huh? Oh.
How about that?
Well, you know, there's an interesting story I like to tell. It's kind of cute. Paul Harvey would have fun with it. My mom was a teacher in one-room schoolhouses in central Minnesota when she was a young woman. And she used to be the principal, the janitor. She stoked the furnace. She taught the class. She was the school nurse, everything. Just these little schoolhouses in the middle of nowhere. She'd teach these classes where half the kids didn't even speak English, a bunch of little German kids, you know. And in 1939, she got this Smith Corona typewriter. Kids had never seen one before. They all gathered around her desk, and they said, Miss Terhar, that was her name then, her maiden name, Miss Terhar, show us how it works. Type something. Well, growing up, she had memorized poems in school, so she typed out various poems that she had memorized. And with every letter that hit that page, the kids were oohing and aahing. They couldn't believe someone had invented something like this. Well, now go to 1998, 99. I decide to go back to the typewriter after experimenting briefly with his whole computer business and finding the whole experience wanting. I ended up getting an old 1930 Underwood number 5. And who comes around my kids? The same thing. Show us how it works, Dad. Let's see it work. Type something. And they did the same ooing and on. And to this day, when they have friends over, they come up into my office and they all gather around it. Computer, well, that's normal. That's like a microwave. That's.
I mean, my friends call those confusers. What you got? The typewriter in front of me. Well, I just called up because I've never called before. I listened 5 or 6 years, and I just thought you might like to hear about it.
Yeah, that's great that you saved it. I got to thinking when I was reading this story about this guy in New Haven, Connecticut, who's considered, he's 90 years old, he's considered one of the last, Hey, did I even talk about this yet? Were you calling because I talked about this? Or...
No, sir, I've always wanted to call, but had nothing to say before.
Wow, this is weird. When I saw you up there, I just assumed I had already talked about this earlier in the show, and then I realized I haven't. Today I was going to have a guy on who repairs old typewriters, a 90-year-old guy in New Haven, Connecticut. He was written about today as the last typewriter repairman in America. And he was too shy to go on, but I had a nice conversation with him this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, by golly, it's just coincidental then that you're calling. But this...
You know, there's a pristine ribbon in the darn thing. Ain't that hot?
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can find the story a second. So, are you using that thing?
Well, I will be. I'm cleaning it now. I've oiled the keys and the took of the dust. There was feathers and leaves and things in it. Someone had cat hair all over. I cleaned it pretty darn good, and it works. There's nothing wrong with it. It's brand new.
Front page of the Christian Science Monitor today. Manson Whitlock peers into the typewriter on the table. It's a big avocado green manual typewriter. He works on it. Out goes the screw, using a spring hook, an implement that looks like it could come from a dentist's office. He reassembles a typewriter. He's 90 years old. He's sitting in a tweed jacket, silk tie. He's been working on typewriters since 1930. Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight was a fresh memory of his when he first started working on computers. Whitlock's typewriter shop is jammed with tools, books, machines, and memories that have accumulated over the past 77 years. Boy, wouldn't you like to go into this guy's shop? There used to be an old guy on Grand Avenue in St. Paul who reminds me of this Whitlock fella, and he used to work on them, and he'd allow me to go into the back room while he worked on them. And then sometimes he'd take a break, and he'd grab a banjo, and he'd sing me a song. He's long gone now. Well, I'm glad you rescued that thing. You see them a lot at garage sales. Sometimes people get a little carried away, price them as though they're extraordinary antiques. Some are, some aren't. Mm-hmm. But
I got a caretaker friend, and when they move out, he doesn't care. He says, you want something? No. Well, I wanted the typewriter. Mm-hmm. I just wonder what kind of a model it is. All it says is Royal in red on it.
You sure you can't find a serial number?
Well, yeah, the serial number's here.
Yeah, well, with that serial number... Uh-huh. You should be able to determine what this guy told me with mine was, actually, you know what?
What?
You ought to write that serial number down and call this guy. He did it for me. He has a little book right next to his phone. You ought to call him. I can put you on hold and Speed can give you his number. Call out to New Haven. He answers the phone and he'll tell you the year of that thing.
Yeah, there is. It's stamped right by the ribbon holder.
Yeah, just tell him it's a Royal and tell him the serial number. And just ask if he wouldn't mind, say you're calling from the Twin Cities. If he sees you're willing to make a long-distance call, he'll just grab that book and give it to you.
Thanks, Tom.
Let me put you on hold here. You still have his number, Speed? He's getting it. He'll get it for you. Great old guy. He says, airplanes, automobiles, television, and computers, they've all gone and changed the world too quickly. World was nice 75 years ago. It changed too fast, he says. What am I going to do with that barrel of oil?
Now, back to Mishki on AM 1500. KSTP.
Come on, Cecil, take a chill. But I finally get up into a hole, but you pinball machine, and he said, come on, see, give me a dollar. Come on, see, so give me five. I'm in a halfway house on one-way street. Ooh, I'm quarter past
seven. This is your broadcast coming to you on a Friday in the glorious Upper Midwest. We're sublime weekend awaits. I just can't say enough about the next 48 hours. It's just going to be a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time to be alive up here in the North Country. I hope you celebrate by doing less. We all need to do a lot less, each of us. Stephen Hawking wasn't doing much of anything yesterday. He was just floating around. He just wanted to float. We all should take a lesson from Steve. Smart guy. Could have been solving some problem. Instead, he was just floating around. Free of his wheelchair, tethered only to some heart rate monitors. He fulfilled a dream of his by floating weightless on a zero-gravity jet. A step he hopes leads to further space adventures. Now, he's in rough shape physically. Unable to talk, unable to walk, unable to move his hands or legs. He's only able to make tiny facial expressions using the muscles around his eyes and around his mouth. He has to raise an eyebrow to signal yes and tense his mouth to signal no. He uses a computer attached to his wheelchair to talk for him in a synthesized voice by choosing words on a screen through an infrared sensor on a headpiece that detects a motion in his cheek. It's an extraordinary thing to watch, but he wanted to experience weightlessness. So they got him up there. They got him in one of those zero-gravity jets, and he was floating around, and it didn't all go well. We sort of lost control of him, says Flight Leader James Turner. For a little bit, things didn't go the way we would have hoped. We just lost a little control. Stephen started floating toward the back of the plane, bouncing off some of the equipment, just sort of slipped into the rear of the jet there. He was up by the ceiling hitting some of the safety equipment boxes, and then he careened off a decompression lever into a generator before we could get to him. He was starting to spin backwards, actually rather rapidly, before we could leap up and tackle him. We brought him down to the floor of the plane. He was bleeding pretty badly, just wanted to go back to Cambridge. In a lot of ways, it was a disaster, but he's alive. How old is Stephen Hawking? Let's see. 65. The very first person with a disability to experience this zero-gravity situation. As Stephen said, I've been wheelchair-bound for 4 decades. The chance to float free was just wonderful. I imagine it's the feeling I will have when I die and my spirit leaves my body and heads up to heaven. Wait a minute. I'm a scientist. I'm an atheist. Check that. But it's a hell of a feeling, and I'd like to know, be the first disabled person to head up into space. Anybody familiar with the Richard Gere situation? If you go to YouTube and you punch in Richard Gere kiss, there's a disturbing image of him, well, attacking a woman on a stage in India. I don't know any other way to say it. He should have been arrested right then and there. India's calling for his arrest. An Indian court acting on a complaint by a local lawyer described the kiss as an obscene act. The kiss sparked sporadic protests in India. He was kissing a woman named Shilpa Shetty. twirled her in his arms, arched her over, kissed her several times on the cheek at an event in New Delhi to promote AIDS awareness among Indian truckers. There's been so much paparazzi involved in this and so much discussion and so much criticism that Gere is really upset now. He's being quoted in the press today saying, quote, end the circus, please, unquote. Let's end the circus. All right? That's what he says. I don't say that. I say, I say, make it a real circus. It's not a circus yet, Richard. I say turn it into a circus. Turn the Gere-kissing story into an event for the whole family with clowns and elephants and trapeze artists, lion tamers. Make it a circus. You could go either way. Gere says end the circus. I say finish it. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey and Richard Gere Faux Pas Circus, featuring the Hollywood actor coming out of a little Volkswagen, maybe, with a bright red wig. Big sign on his head that says, I'm a Buddhist. Can't you tell? If you do bring up this YouTube scene of Dick Gere, I call him Dick Gere, if you do bring that up and watch Richard with this woman, you may want to have a little circus music. Man. No, this one. Yeah. Now, there it is. Now it's a circus, Richard. Kissing everyone, bending the girls backwards. Wouldn't it be nice to take a bona fide circus and bring it to a media event and make a media event a circus for once, make it a real circus? We're always operating in metaphors. I don't like that. Maybe this is another one, I don't know. The headline from this story is Bush readies his pen to strike down Iraq pullout bill. He's readying the pen. Well, what does that involve? Bush readies pen to strike down Iraq pullout bill. Is that pen ready? I want the pen. I want it ready to go. I want it functioning in all the different ways a pen can function. I want it near me. I want it right here. I want it checked over. I want it given the green light by examiners. Take a look at it. I want it certified, too. I want to know that there is a backup if something goes wrong with that pen. Where is the pen right now? Get it up here. I want to see it. I want to have it in a little holster nearby. Clip it to my belt, will you, Dick? Dick, clip it right there. Come on, don't be a baby. Clip it right there. This doggone thing is going to be so ready, it'll be able to veto things on its own. Freaking Democrats think they can push me around. The pen's mightier than the sword, boys. One day I'm going to charge into Iran with a whole bunch of pens. But for now, I'm going to use one mighty and powerful pen to stick a dagger in the heart of the liberal, commie, homo-loving, godless Democrats. I'll tell you what, no offense to you, Dick. I know your daughter's a homo, but she's female, and it's always easier for us guys to accept the homo female rather than the homo male, so I cut you some slack there. Even though clearly you did something creepy to have her turn out that way in the first place. But that's none of my business. I don't care about that. I know you're still, in a lot of ways, a Republican, though not full-blooded, what with the gay daughter and all. So. Now, where was I? The pen. The pen! I'm going to put it right here. No, I'll take care of that, Dick. Get away from me. Get you, Speed. Ah, I hear what you're saying. I was supposed to do that, aren't I? Sorry about that. I thought that was your job. I can't find the doggone thing. Why, this is embarrassing. Let's play another ad. There's the doggone thing. It's gone. Who took it? Oh, doggone it. Found it. There. That adds a lot, I think, don't you? Hi. Join us weekday mornings at 8:05 for Talkin' Twins. That's Talk apostrophe N Twins. You'll find a segment pack full of exclusive content and interviews. Exclusive content? I don't like that term. Exclusive content? Can we come up with a... Johnny, what's better to say? Pack full of... exclusive content and interviews you'll hear here first, only on AM 1500 DKSTP. Hi. Hey, everybody. I got my own radio show. That wind just seems to go on, doesn't it?
Does it ever stop?
I don't know. Talking Twins, 8:05 mornings. It's a nor'easter, I think, right there. She should be wrapping up shortly, and then we'll go to news. Huh. Says here 4 minutes left. Tell you what, maybe what we can do is find a volume control and just fade it out yourself, and people won't know that you did that. They'll just think the wind faded on its own. Go ahead and do that. Yeah, that sounds good, to just do that. Hi, John. What do you have?
Hi,
news?
Tommy. Yes.
It's Friday. Don't bring them down.
Oh, thanks.
They're going up the country. It's a beautiful weekend, and they're bugging out. They're tearing out of town in their pickups with their wives and kids in tow, and they don't want to be brought down.
Partly sunny, breezy, apparently, and 70 degrees. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman's car was rear-ended by a drunk driver last night.
Oh, man.
Happened on Summit Avenue at Victoria Street while the black unmarked Crown Victoria stopped at a light. 22-year-old Abby Raymond of St. Paul was arrested. Police say she blew a .26 on the breathalyzer. There was little damage to either car. Nobody was hurt. You might remember about a year ago, a car full of teenagers hit the mayor's car on I-94.
What are they doing? What's they have an in for them? You know, I now kind of want to do something.
Hit his car?
Yeah. I know where he lives. Does he bring his car home every night? Is that the deal?
Apparently, yes, yeah.
I'm going to do something to his car.
Well, remember last year when he got hit by the teens, he's got emergency lights, he turned them on.
No, not while he's in it. I'm going to do it in the middle of the night.
Oh, I see. Yeah. All right. Well, good thing you didn't say that over the radio, so.
I'm going to, what could you do that wouldn't get you arrested but would let him know you had visited?
I don't know.
All I can think is shaving cream, but I want to move beyond that. You ever egg a car, John?
Egged a car, Tommy.
That looks like something that's innocent until the body shop gets involved.
I've heard that.
I was a boy, I did not know that eggs could do that kind of damage. I didn't know they took the paint off. So don't egg people. Don't egg.
The only thing I ever threw at a car was a tomato. And then I felt so bad afterward that I only did it once, so.
Yeah. Wouldn't it have been a shame, and I wonder whether you'd be doing this job today, if after you threw that, it swerved, went up on the curb, hit a telephone pole, and a 67-year-old grandmother was killed. Yeah. I wonder what you'd be doing today.
So you're telling me not to bring him down, huh?
Well, it didn't happen.
But it could have, apparently.
Yeah, because you were already feeling guilty with it airborne, but what if then you hear the screech, that god-awful screaming?
That would have been bad.
Yeah,
yes,
and it was their 40th or 50th anniversary or something. Oh. They had just been on Paul Harvey. And you're looking out there seeing Jane Mansfield, too.
Oh. A CIA spokesman calls the capture of an Iraqi man a significant victory in the fight against terror. Guantanamo Bay detainee described as one of Al-Qaeda's most senior, most experienced operatives. One intelligence official says he was captured late last year. One way or another, there's going to be a statewide smoking ban. The Senate passed one, and yesterday the House passed its own version. Conferees will now work out the differences, submit a final bill to the governor, who says he will sign it. The whole process has left a bad taste in the mouth of a lot of folks who were against it, like Jordan Republican Mark Biskins. He was on the Bob Davis Show this morning here on AM 1500.
The other fundamental problem with this bill is the continual encroachment of the nanny state on people's lives and how that wears down on the character of people who, you know, should be all about individual choice, individual responsibility, and at the core, freedom.
One bill starts the ban this summer, the other not until 2009. They'll have that worked out, too, in conference. And Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling is offering $1 million to anyone who can prove that was not blood on his sock in the 2004 playoffs. The offer comes after a broadcaster stirred controversy by reporting it was paint, not blood, from an ankle injury. Broadcaster Gary Thorne.
Now, that sounds bold, but it's impossible to prove either way now.
Well, couldn't
impossible.
They get a DNA sample from the blood? Somebody brought that up yesterday. Because the sock is in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Yeah, sock is in the Hall of Fame.
Well, he ought to have that done to it. Don't do this million-dollar nonsense. Pay to have DNA done on it independently, and let's all learn the answer together. Okay. That's what he should do.
I think it was blood. I'm no Curt Schilling or Boston Red Sox fan, but I think it was blood.
You know, most people who don't like or trust Curt Schilling believe it's blood. They just believe that he pressed the sock into it with dramatic effect. Seriously.
Just to make
sure. They believe that there was some blood, and he made sure it got on the sock. Mm-hmm. No one actually believes it was painted.
No. By the way, the broadcaster, Gary Thorne, said last night his report was mistaken. 5 Eyewitness News weather forecast. Partly cloudy and isolated shower tonight, down to 52. Sunny and warmer over the weekend. Beautiful. 79 tomorrow. 83 on Sunday. Right now, 70 degrees at AM 1500.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Sorry, I'm on the phone. I shouldn't be doing this during the program. Jim, standing by. Where are you, Jim?
Jimmy? I'm at home.
Why? What kind of a life you got there? What are you doing? Just playing guitar today? Pretending you're Jimmy Buffett?
More Jimi Hendrix than Jimmy Buffett.
Oh, the hell you say. I bet you periodically get some shrimp boiling and find yourself wearing a parrot head.
I'm actually not that big a Jimmy Buffett fan. No. I like a few songs, but he actually does some lousy stuff, too, frankly.
One time I was listening to KQ, and...
Why?
I don't know. I punch around, you know. We all do it. And they had Jimmy Buffett on. And I stopped, and I thought, you know, this isn't really a rock song. They had that Margaritaville on.
Right.
I kind of felt embarrassed for him because I thought, you know, this
it's
really
pandering.
It's elevator music now, and they were playing it.
Yeah, it's pandering. Unless you're drunk, you don't want to be playing Margaritaville.
So I hung in there because I knew afterwards the DJ would have to say that was Jimmy Buffett. And I just had this feeling even he'd be a little squeamish about the whole... Is that the right term? I don't know.
Close enough.
So the song ends... And he says, you know, Jimmy Buffett wrote some pretty good songs, but he's kind of a dork. And I said, yeah, see, he felt weird about it, too. There was just a weird feeling. It wasn't Light FM. What was going on there?
I like it. Hey, by the way, I compliment. So you actually played Ricky Lee Jones earlier this hour. I'm not a big Ricky Lee Jones fan anymore, but in college I listened to her a lot.
I listened to her a lot in college as well. I like her version of Under the Boardwalk.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you got planned for the weekend?
NFL draft. I'm afraid I will be...
freaking bore.
Oh, it's awful. It's the worst thing there is. In fact, Royce every year tries to find a way to not be around, so I have to do it. Which, actually, I don't complain. You know, as a sports writer, I feel obligated because it's what everybody's talking about. But it's, you know, look at last year. Viking fans and NFL quote-unquote analysts spent, you know, 500,000 man hours studying the thing, breaking it down, trying to figure out who would be there, trying to figure out who they should get if the person they wanted wasn't there, listening to the lies from the NFL people and the Vikings people. Then you get down to it. They take Chad Greenway, you know, an average linebacker from Iowa. We all write about it. He hurts his knee. He misses the year. I mean, shouldn't we have all spent our time last spring doing something else other than trying to figure out who they're going to draft?
What number in the draft was Tom Brady?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me. He's a fourth or a sixth round draft pick, which means, you know,
100
times, 30 times, I mean, good Lord, he's...
Close to 200.
200. And Joe Montana was a third round pick.
So, is it the story that some teams have guys with really good skills at picking people, or that some teams have guys who it isn't so important what the guy's like when he arrives. It's what they can do with him with their skilled training and educating and approach to the game. Was Tom Brady made into a great athlete, a great football player, a great quarterback after the draft? Or did people fail to see his abilities?
I think it's more that they failed to see his abilities.
How is that possible?
Well, here, I'll give you an example. I once talked to Bill Walsh, you know, the genius of all time, according to everybody who's ever covered the NFL, right?
Yeah.
The genius of all time, the offensive guru of all time, the quarterback guru of all time. And he's been given a lot of credit for taking Joe Montana in the third round of the draft. You know, oh, my God, you waited till the third round, you still got one of the best quarterbacks ever to play.
And to help people out and understand this, third would be... How many picks down again? We're talking 90.
80, 70, right. 90, something
okay.
like that.
All right.
So, yeah, so 80 players go before maybe the greatest quarterback of all time gets selected by Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh has actually admitted this, and I admire him for admitting this. If you think, if you're smart enough to think that Joe Montana, this guy who was a pretty good quarterback at Notre Dame, is going to be one of the greatest of all time, then you're stupid. You're an absolute moron for allowing him to last till the third round, for allowing every other team in the draft two or three shots at taking him instead of you getting him. So they didn't know what they had. They thought he was maybe a little underrated. They thought he was a nice player. They didn't know they were getting one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time in the third round. If they had, they would have taken him in the first round.
Well, how come these guys don't show those abilities in college ball?
Well, college ball is a completely different game.
It's not really.
Yes, it is. It really is. First of all, you don't know exactly how good their offensive system is. You don't know how good their offensive line is. You don't know how good their receivers are. You don't know, you know, they might be playing against defenses that are really able to take away the things that offense is trying to do. Montana did not have great arm strength. He was not a particularly big guy, wasn't a muscle guy. He's not the kind of guy who would test well if you ran him through a battery of tests at the NFL Combine. He just had instincts, intuition, great football, and I talked to Montana. You talk to him and you think, this is a dumb guy. And yet, on the field, he's one of the brightest guys who's ever played the game. So if you go by the things the NFL teams go by these days, which is, you know, psychological tests, intelligence tests.
Why do they do that when it's known, when we know now that there are at least, I believe, 22 different ways to measure intelligence, and physical intelligence is a completely different thing, and we know that. That's 2007. It's not nearly as important how bright someone is IQ-wise for athletics, but their athletic intelligence is a separate thing that can be tested, and they don't test that?
It's all fear. They have 4 months, or really, I mean, they really work year-round on this stuff, but they have 4 months to really intensively break down the draft, and it's fear of being second-guessed, fear of not knowing something about the guy that will come to light later. And it's interesting. I'm reading, did you ever read Blink by Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes.
I'm most of the way through that. I've read, you know, other stuff by him. And it's a book about the power of human intuition, the power of gut feelings, the power of seeing something and recognizing it for what it is without really knowing exactly why you feel that way.
Right.
And the NFL has gone the other way. The NFL has gone, we need, because we might get second guess on this later, because so much is at stake in terms of money and the future of our franchise, we have to overanalyze everything.
Well,
I think overanalysis leads to really stupid mistakes.
Yeah, it makes sense in this sense. In the West, the ability to turn to your fans and say, sorry, I screwed up, but I had a real strong
exactly.
gut feeling on this guy, that's not going to cut it here. Maybe in the East that would be held up higher than any stats, but I understand that you can't make that case to your boss. Unfortunately, you can't. I have a feeling, though, that there, I don't know, maybe if you went back and looked at Montana or you went back and looked at Brady, instead of just saying gut feeling, you could have said, here were the signs, we just missed them.
Yeah, well, you could, because Montana was a very inspirational player at Notre Dame. He wasn't, again, not that big, not that fast, not a strong arm, but he made great throws at great times. And Brady, Brady... Again, I don't have all the history right in front of me, but he's a guy who had trouble winning the starting job at the University of Michigan, and he turns out to be, again, one of the top 10 quarterbacks of all time.
I have something I want to play for you that I took it from Willie and Jay's show last Monday. It was a John Gordon quote, and I I saved it because I wanted you to comment on it. I'm very serious about it, though, because he's He's saying something that I've wanted to ask you about for a long time, and I haven't remembered to. Play what John Gordon says, Speed.
Now, there is such a thing as the twin system, guys, and it's different than what other clubs, you know, present. And when you bring a guy in, you ask him to behave, you ask him to, you know, be on time, you ask him to do his work, and you ask him to, you know, be get along with his teammates. And not a whole lot more than that. You know, it's not not a real tough job. All they got to do is just be there and you know, get their work in. And that's what Ramon Ortiz has done. He's been a very, very good, you know, pitcher for the Twins. And I'd be shocked if he, you know, if he falls off here. I think he'll be just about the same as what we've got.
This notion of a system here, Gordon was making the point. They were asking him about people coming from other organizations to the Twins. Is there something that goes on with the Minnesota Twins that doesn't occur with other ball clubs?
Well, I think they are more, you know, I talk about scouting and development and all those things. The Twins really work incredibly hard at this stuff.
And other people don't.
Well, now, you know, I've been to a lot of ballparks. I've been around a lot of scouts. The Twins pride themselves on the extra 5%. They pride themselves on not leaving a high school game until the end, whereas another scout might come in, see the one player he wants to leave in the fourth inning to beat the, you know, to get someplace else. They really do pride on themselves on those things. But let me say this. The Twins had the same philosophies in place when they were losing 100 games a year in the late 90s. And there's a danger of what Gardo is talking about, which is caring so much about having really good guys who are always on time and who are always good teammates who can't play the game. And what the trick is to pride yourself on the things Gordo's talking about, but also find talented guys who can make a difference on the field. Because you can have that philosophy about good guys, hardworking guys, good teammates, and you can still lose 100 games a year.
I almost think that system is intended as much to make the manager's life easy as to make the ball club win more. Obviously, a club where everybody's getting along is going to be an easier club to manage. That's what's difficult when you got to be a manager with a lot of egos and a lot of different personalities. Both Gardy and Kelly had a philosophy where they didn't want a lot of ego around.
No, very true. And again, there might have been times where that's hurt this team because they didn't want to take a chance on a very talented guy or a talented free agent because they're afraid he wouldn't fit in their clubhouse. But, and it's, that's, I have to defend that philosophy to this extent. The Twins can't afford, unlike the Yankees or the Red Sox, they can't afford to swing and miss on somebody as much as those teams can. Other teams can pay to erase their mistakes. If the Twins make a mistake and they bring in a guy who's a jerk and they feel like they have to get rid of him, that's going to set them back a lot farther than it's going to set back a big money team. And also, because they accept that they're not going to have the most talented roster in the big leagues year in and year out, having good guys around the clubhouse, guys who function well, guys who allow them to maybe play a little bit better than they really are, is more important here than it is elsewhere.
Now you're starting to see this bleed over a little bit into the Vikings with this draft coming up. For the first time, at least in my life. I'm hearing people talk about they got removed from the list for character issues.
Well, that's always happened to a certain extent. What's happening now is now that Roger Goodell is saying, if you're a big problem, we're going to suspend you from the league. Now it's even more incumbent upon the teams to make sure they don't bring somebody in who they could lose the services of for 6 months or for a year if the guy's a jackass.
Is that what it really is?
Yes.
Over Childress saying, I want the community here, the fans, to be proud of the team?
You know, they come in, they bring out this 18,000-page code of conduct, and then Dwight Smith messes up, and he's still brought back. Cedric Griffin, now a key cornerback for them, messes up. You know, they might be punishing him behind the scenes, but not much is made of it. Bryant McKinney is on the Love Boat. He's one of the guys who's most involved with that. They sign him after the fact. They sign him to a huge long-term contract. Their actions do not match their words in this regard.
Is it fair to say that it's easier to have a Twins philosophy of finding good people, good teammates as well as good athletes than it is in football? Is it fair to say that people in baseball just have it easier because that sport has more people like that than football does?
I think so. The mentality you witness when you're around these sports is football players tend to think of themselves as bigger than life, as as superhuman, as people. They've been treated as the big man on campus ever since they were, you know, a sophomore in high school. They've been told how big a deal they are. They play a sport that rewards violence, that rewards, you know, marauding behavior. You're
right.
If you're a defensive player, you're one of 11 guys, and you're taught to go kill somebody together. Baseball players, in terms of off-the-field behavior, they probably do as many shady things as football players, but they tend to do it one at a time, or, you know, I mean, they tend to kind of be private about it. They tend to be smarter about it. They tend to not think that they're entitled to behave any way they want. If they do something stupid, at least they're smart enough to try to hide the behavior. Football players sometimes are proud of bad behavior.
Right, right. That, my friend, will do it for us. You have the rest of the day off?
I have today off.
And
by the way, Johnny Hyatt, you got to ask him. I was told by somebody in the local guitar community, if there is such a thing, that he actually writes for a vintage guitar.
Yeah, he writes reviews, and I've asked him to bring them in often, and he hasn't, but he gets a bunch of great music sent to him free and has the luxury of listening and writing about it, and yeah, that's his little side job.
That's pretty cool.
You ought to see his collection sometime, 17,000 albums in
his
basement.
I want to see his guitar collection is what I want to see.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys, we should have you in for a Friday hootenanny sometime.
That'd be great.
All right, Jimmy, have a good weekend. Bye-bye. There goes Suhan. I'm out of here as well. Sue Sheree is next. This is KSTP. Good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. Thanks for listening. Have one hell of a weekend. If you can't have a hell of a weekend this weekend, I think it's just time to check out. She's going to be a beautiful one.